Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
If scary movies give you dread, keep you up late night in bed, here's a podcast that will help you ease your mind. We'll explain the plot real nicely, then we'll talk about what's frightening so you never have to have a spooky time. It's Ruined.
Hello, welcome to Ruined. I'm Hallie.
And I'm Allison.
This is a podcast. We ruin a horror movie just for you.
Just for each and every one of you. Hallie, how are you?
It's been a long week. We're recording this the Friday before Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Traveling is not a vacation for me, but I'm excited to not have work part of the week.
Are you traveling for Thanksgiving?
Yes, I'm going to Cleveland, my hometown. Well, Northeast Ohio, and then driving down to Columbus. So a tour of Ohio. Excited to see everybody. What about you? What are you doing?
I am staying put.
Do you travel like in will you travel next month?
No, pre-pandemic even, I made a rule because it was getting so, my parents are a train ride away. It's not like it's like super far. It's like under 3 hours on Amtrak, but it was getting so expensive no matter what time of day, and it was getting so, like, stressful, and, like, my schedule kept changing, and I was just like, let's make a new rule that, like, I'm not coming home for any holidays. Like, I'm just not doing it anymore. Like, we can reevaluate every year, but, like, I just, like, don't – I'll just – like, I am lucky in that my life is pretty flexible, and I can go randomly, like – so I'm going to go, like, see my parents for, like, a random couple of days – December or January or something
That'll
like that.
Good.
And then we're going to like travel in February. So it's like, I don't know. It's the same amount of time I'm seeing them. I'm just going to do it like at different. And we used to always just go to Aruba over Christmas and New Year's. But we haven't gone exactly that week in a long time for the reasons of not wanting to fly when everyone is flying.
Yeah, that is a tough thing, especially about Thanksgiving. I feel like it's always a mob scene.
Yeah,
I've been staying here for Christmas the last couple of years, which I like because I just feel like I do need days on end to decompress.
Just recharge, yeah.
But yeah, every year I feel like I'm open to reassessing. I just do enjoy that. We are back at it with Hanukkah month. Michael Haneke's oeuvre continues to surprise and delight.
Yes.
Before we get into it, we of course like to share something that we enjoy about the holidays. Allison, and of course, it doesn't have to be specific to Hanukkah or Christmas. We're widening the pool, so feel free to go wide
just
with
kind of the holiday season or kind of any holiday. I like for holiday, like not Christmas, because I know you would like that's like you wake up and it's Christmas. But for like the day of Christmas Eve, the day like we would have our big Hanukkah party with our family and do like a larger gift exchange. Like even Thanksgiving, like I like waking up that morning and having like the slow roll into the day, but also like there's stuff going on. Like there's kind of like a festive feeling of like you're having a cinnamon roll because it's like who cares? We're already going to be happy. You know, it's like there's already cooking smells happening. Like you kind of hang out in your pajamas for a little bit longer and like there's little tasks. I don't know. There's something about kind of like the lead up to events that is always to me more enjoyable than the events themselves. Like getting ready to go to a fancy thing is always more fun than being at the fancy thing. Like
the
pregame with your
recently,
girls is always more fun than like the night out. And I just feel like the day of holidays has that feeling too of like kind of the preppy, not preppy, but like preparation adjacent stuff. And just kind of also that it's like, you don't like typically have to work either. So it's not like a day where it's like, ah, I got to do stuff all day and then do this thing at night. Like, it's mostly just kind of like cleaning something your mom told you.
Yeah, it has the, it sort of makes everything special, even if it's just going to Target. It's like, we went to Target yesterday. You're probably going to go tomorrow. It's Thanksgiving break. But the day of, it takes on a special sheen.
Yes. What about you? What's your enjoyable holiday thing?
I would say, and again, I don't, maybe this shouldn't count, but I do think, similar to what you're saying, I do think going to the movies during the holidays is extra special.
Yes.
What, everyone falls asleep, which I always think is funny.
Yep.
I'm assuming my family and I will see Wicked, Gladiator 2, and or both. As all of America is, and yeah, I just like that there is a collective thing that we all go do. I like that.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I saw all the Harry Potter movies. Like, I have no interest in those films or those books, but they all came out Thanksgiving, so I was like, well, we're all gonna do this.
Yeah, I feel like The Lord of the Rings was that way too, because I remember seeing those and liking them, but not having like any like.
Yeah.
Going into it, fandom.
Yeah, so I think there's something to that. And again, like, I'm going to get Raisinets. I'm going to really do it up, because why not?
Raisinets and popcorn, the ultimate combo.
And then for me, it's a Diet Cherry Coke with a floater of regular Cherry Coke.
Oh, mine
couldn't
is
be
just
happier.
A giant ice-cold Diet Coke.
And other than that, I was going to say ice skating, but I have not ice skated in a million years. But
no,
I support
the thought of the
ice
injuries
skating.
That could come from that is overwhelming.
My bones would explode into a powder. I would be permanently paralyzed, and you'd have to write a movie about me.
Yeah, I would become the stuff they put on the ice after somebody throws up.
Well, speaking of throwing up,
yes.
You won't be doing that during this week's Michael Haneke movie, because the movie is Code Unknown. It is from 2000. Allison, this is not in any way a horror movie. I mean, it covers the horrors of real life. But it is more of, it's a drama. It's vignettes from different people's lives intersecting in Paris and abroad.
Oh, I love it.
And again, I associated Michael Haneke with like Funny Games and The Piano Teacher. So sort of psychosexual trauma.
Yes.
But I really didn't know that so much of his work was also about immigration.
Yeah.
And sort of, this film is about deportation, basically. And the lives of people coming in and out of France and their sort of overlapping lives, but that we're constantly seeking understanding, but limited by our own view of the world and our ability to understand one another, which I think is great. Again, he's a phenomenal filmmaker, but this is like you definitely could watch. This is,
would
highly recommend it. I thought it was really wonderful. Even as someone where I do not love a movie of vignettes,
I know
like a
they're tough
narrative.
Yeah, done well.
Yes,
it's great, but most of the time it's not done well.
Yeah, and I think Michael Haneke did a great job. I think this was really thoughtful, and it was performances were great. We see some familiar faces, from Caché, not just Juliette Binoche, but then also both Majid and younger Majid from Caché, Maurice Benichou. Benichou, I apologize to all French people. He plays
all
Majid
times.
In Caché, and then his son is played by Walid Afkir. Both are in these. Phenomenal. So I like that he has repeat players, and everyone was great in this, as sort of all the different people, the multicultural. It's a sort of like a not even a commentary, just sort of like trying to pick like what is a multicultural, what is an actual multicultural. Like city. What are the actual lives of people in there, and sort of how if you're not from France, your life is constantly filled with anxiety and upheaval. And if you're Juliette Binoche, you know, you have both everyone has both the upheaval of their own lives and like the tragedy of your life, and then also these much more extreme economic realities for immigrants, you know, documented and undocumented, that I thought he'd really do a good job with.
Yeah.
Again, I knew he would. I wasn't surprised.
Right.
But let us begin. We always like to have Allison watch the trailer. Allison, what did you think of the trailer for Code Unknown?
So there is, like, not a searchable trailer for this film
it's
that I could find.
So I guess maybe that would make sense.
Well, it's like I clicked on one and it turned out it was just the first 3 minutes of the movie. And I was like, okay, so I watched that. And then I was like, oh, this just ended. And then I was like, oh, I see. And then Apple had a trailer and it was just kind of like a 3.5 minute scene from, I assume, a related vignette. Like, there is no trailer for this film. So I've watched
it's really
two scenes.
Okay. Great. I think that you probably do you remember tense. Could you tell me what the scenes were? Could you describe them?
The first one was like what I assume was supposed to be like a audition.
Yes.
That Julia Binoche is in, and like, and I was like, oh, I wonder where this goes. Is this like, oh, is this a real audition, or is this actually like the beginning of this woman being kidnapped?
Exactly,
which I'm sure is the intent of the filmmaking. So that was like pretty unsettling, and I was like, oh no. And then the other one was it was her again. It was a fight on the street between an African man, I assume, or a black man, and a white man and a white woman, and then she intervenes, and then the cops get involved, and it's just kind of like a very like also very tense and a lot of but in a very different way.
I was like,
I'm very into whatever's happening, but it was really hard to figure out like what exactly we are getting into from those two videos.
Absolutely. Well, I'm excited. I feel like that scene with her is probably the most like famous scene from this movie, and it's really well done. Again, Julia Binoche, an incredible actress. We always like to take a baseline scary for Allison. Allison, how scary do you find the concept of I guess our inability to form an actual multicultural world because of neoliberalism, where we basically cannot accept the fact that things do fundamentally have to change.
Yes, it is scary. We are living it. It is an awful reality to have to kind of grapple with every day as you see people thinking that they are leading the charge towards a better world and realize they are just upholding systems that will never, ever, ever yield to any improvement for most people.
Yeah, and I feel like it's sort of, you know, and I think this is also, he's making a commentary on, like, the arts as well. Like, Julia Binoche's character is an actress. She's in a movie within the movie. I think he's sort of grappling with, like, so what do I do if this is what I do? How do I, what is the value of this in a world where people's lives are, like, constantly being torn apart? And I think that this is what you do. You know what I mean? I think, like, you know, obviously all of his movies are a social commentary, and I think this is sort of what his attempt to do that, and I think he is has a lot of is effective in a lot of ways. It's interesting. I was trying to look for some reviews, and I didn't find a lot from like that time period. But also, and not that this matter, it was, but it might. But where it's like this is pre 9/11, so I'm like, I wonder if this movie, like, because I just feel like everything changed so much. Such an extreme way.
And if this came out in 2000, in like, I mean, I don't know what the U.S. release would have been, but it might have been after that. Like, it might have really just come, it might be kind of a glitter situation where it came out pretty close to 9/11.
Yeah, that's true. And I feel like it feels really fresh. Like, I feel like all of the stuff he's exploring, more relevant than ever, you know, it feels like it could be made about this, you know, time period. And also, this is inspired by, it's not about, but it's sort of inspired by the war reporter Olivier Weber. One of the characters is a war reporter who comes back, and it's sort of his his story is sort of like, how do you go from being in these conflict areas and sort of seeing the truth about the world, or at least a truth that, you know, people in America, you know, a lot of us don't want to accept or engage with.
Yeah.
And then how do you sort of go back to Paris? Like, how do you adjust? And the answer maybe is that you can't. And, you know, it's a really interesting, I think a lot of people who end up doing that kind of work, I think, I don't know, not that like they don't ever come back, but like, I do think that that's like a constant issue. Like, once you know something, you can't unknow it, you know?
Right.
And for us, we have the film version of it.
Yes.
And then finally, this is not a movie with that's going to have a twist, but I'm going to have you guess the twist anyways.
Okay.
And just by which I mean, I want you to guess what happens. Just guess where, let's say Juliette Binoche's character ends at the end of the film. How about that?
Okay,
as somebody we know, isn't it? Also, would you like to guess the twist in Code Unknown?
Guess the twist.
I'm going to guess that she's like waiting to find out about this movie and that the end doesn't get it.
Okay, great.
But that's kind of like the closed and like, we've been following her since the audition and with the back and forth and everything like that and seeing kind of like the ways that she moves through a multicultural Paris. But ultimately, at the end, she doesn't get the part.
Great. Love it. All right. Let us begin. I'm just making sure. There's kind of a cast of thousands, so I wanted to have the IMDb good. Up when I inevitably forget some of them and or mispronounce their names. I apologize to people from all over the beautiful world for how I'm about to pronounce your names. Let's see. Boop, boop, boop. And this movie is obviously highly regarded. Like, it's well-reviewed and, you know.
Yes.
And also, the full title is Code Unknown, Incomplete Tales of Several Journeys.
Okay.
So to set you up for that, let us ruin Michael Haneke's Code Unknown. We see a little girl, and she's sort of nervously creeping away from the camera, sort of shrinking into a crouch and staring directly into the lens. And then she stops and she smiles and she looks out like, huh, did you get it? And all of the children watching, like it's a classroom, start signing their answers. So it's a sign language. They're all deaf students. And they're trying to guess what was the charades that she was doing. And one kid says, hiding place, alone, gangsters, sad, guilty conscious, locked up. And the girl just looks more and more distraught because nobody's figuring it out.
Okay.
Title, Code Unknown. An incomplete accord of various journeys. We meet Anne. So, okay, Anne and George Larroch are also the main characters in Cachet.
Okay.
The Julia Binoche's name is Anne Larroch. She is not the same character.
Michael.
And also, we meet George Larroch, her boyfriend, who is the war journalist.
Yeah.
He is not the same George, nor is he played by the same actor. So I think maybe he made these characters. It was like, oh, you know what? I think I have a film for them.
I
think that's kind of fun. So we see Anne walk out of her beautiful, like she's got like an apartment building that you know is beautiful from the outside because the door is just like a slate gray against concrete.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't have a lobby because whatever's up there is really nice. She comes down and she is called out to by a 17-year-old named Jean, who rushes over to greet her. Jean is her boyfriend George's younger brother, and George is currently in Kosovo on assignment.
Okay.
And he's like, where's George? I tried to call. He's like, oh, he left 3 weeks ago. What are you doing? Why are you in Paris? He's like, well, where is he? She said, well, he's in Kosovo. And he's very exasperated, and she says, well, I'm walking. Could you walk with me? And he's like, also, when did you get to the city? What's going on? He's like, your fucking door code's changed. She's like, oh, yeah, sorry. He's like, and I called up, but I got the machine. He says, I needed a place to stay. I ran away. Okay. And it's like, oh, yeah, did you? Okay. Right. We see them walking down the streets of Paris. There's like a wall of flowers at this giant flower shop. And he tells Anne, I hate him. And he's referring to George and his father who runs the farm. Okay. A lot of father stuff in these movies, a lot of farms.
Yeah.
He said he's fixing up the old barn to move in there, and he wants me to take over the farm. And Anne's like, that seems like a pretty sweet deal. I mean, like, why not do that? And Jean's still really upset. She says, well, let me go get you something to eat. She goes into a patisserie and gets a pastry for herself, and Jean gives it to him, and they start walking. And she's like, I'm sorry, I must have been in the bathroom when you called. I didn't hear the phone call. And Jean again is saying, like, you know, I just can't stand to live with him. It's just me and him out there now that George is in the city. And she's like, I know, but, like, that's normal for him to want you to take over the farm. It's a cattle farm. And John explains, like, I'm not taking over. That's what he wants. I'm not going back. I'm going to move to Paris. I'm going to have my own life. She says, I hear you, but you do have to do what he says until you're 18. So once you're 18, you're legally adult.
Yes.
I'm exhausted. I can't deal with this right now. The play just opened. I have to go get the papers and read the reviews. I got to bed at 4:30 because the show just opened. Ugh. And I have a meeting in 48 minutes. So just take my keys, go back upstairs. The code is 48B13. And if you want to just conk out on the couch, you know, I'll come back and we can sort of sort things out when I get back, okay?
Yeah.
And she says, but I'll be telling you now, you remember my place? It doesn't fit three people. Now, obviously, having lived in New York, when you see your place, it's like, well, you could fit a third in there for a little while.
Right.
But I get it. He's a teenager, so I'm sure she's like, okay, like, well, whether this is going to happen, it's not going to happen now because I'm not dealing with this.
Physical space. It's also the emotional space that somebody like that will take up in your home.
Yeah. And she says, also, any calls, just let them go to the answering machine. I always do, and I'll just get them later. And she kisses him goodbye, and she heads on, and Jean heads back to their apartment, eating his pastry solemnly. Mm-hmm. And he looks down an alley. We see a street performer playing and people sort of gathered around, you know what I mean, busy city streets. And we see a woman sitting sort of like on the step down from the alley. It's like an inside alley with storefronts like facing in. Uh-huh. And so she's sitting on a step, but it's, you know, like... she's not standing out in public. She just happens to be like, it's like she's just sitting down and there's a right. crowd around her. And as he walks by, he finishes his pastry, crumples up the paper and throws it in her lap like she's a trash can.
Okay.
A man in the crowd, and I should note that Jean and Anne are both white. A man okay. named Amadou, he is black and he is yes. also an immigrant, as we'll find out later. He runs after Jean and taps on the shoulders like, that was fucked up. You have to go apologize to that woman. You can't just throw okay. trash on people on the street like they're garbage.
Right.
And he says, was that a decent thing to do? And Jean says, fuck you. I don't tell you what to do. I don't know you. And Amadou grabs him by the collar and hauls him back to the woman and says, you apologize to her. And Amadou's older, but he's like in his 20s. Like he's yeah, not yeah, like yeah, a, yeah. an adult
this is
man.
The scene I saw.
Yeah. yeah. And they start grappling with each other. Sean's like, let go of me. You can't tell me what to do. And a man comes out of one of the shops yelling at them to break it up. And he's calling them hooligans. You know, he just thinks they're brawling. The woman who had trash on her picks up her stuff and starts to hustle away. Because she's like, I'm not going to fucking
involved
with that.
Yeah, I don't
want to
be
that.
Involved like, in whatever's going on.
Yeah, I don't want trash thrown on me. But I also don't want to, like, get punched in the face by either of these guys.
No, and, or have to, like, get involved in a yes. long and tedious involvement with whatever law enforcement's going to show up and ask me questions.
Exactly. And Amadou says, no, don't go, don't go. Anne hears all this because Anne's like only a block away. Anne runs back and is like, how dare you for picking out a kid, is yelling at Amadou. Of course, she doesn't know what's happened. It's right. like in his face. And he's like, well, of course, he doesn't know. Anne is just like, whose business is yours? Like, I didn't talk to you. Right. Sean's not talking, so he's trying to storm away. Amadou's not really explaining himself either. And, of course, finally the police run over. And they start hauling everyone apart. And Amadou starts to explain, like, this guy humiliated this woman who was just asking for money. And they say, which woman? And another person goes, her with the yellow bag. And one of the cops, named Victor, runs over to the woman and grabs her by the coat and hauls her back. So now they're treating everyone yeah. like criminals.
Yes.
And this woman is also like, and not that it matters, nobody of any age should be manhandled by the police, but like obviously 50, 60 years old,
yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
was just walking away, is not posing any problems to anyone.
Right.
The cops start
no
asking,
one seemed threatened by her.
Exactly. But of course the cops are now going to haul everyone and right. like sort of like demanding everyone giving them their ID. And he tells the man, the shopkeeper who came out, he said, like, yeah, the woman's usually banging out in front of the shop. I, you know, I can make a statement if you want. Allison, the police ask the woman for her ID. She does not have one. She is undocumented.
Oh.
Amadou is asking for his ID. He God. Has one. And he gives it back. But then the cops give Anne and Jean their IDs back, but not Amadou. And this is obviously racial profiling.
Yes.
As he has an ID and is here legally. And they say, you can come down to the station and give a statement. And they refuse to give him back his passport. And he, of course, is really upset with that. He tries to resist and not go. The cops are on him and they start manhandling him to haul him down to the station. So now he and Maria are in trouble because he sort of tried to intervene on this. And it's hard because, like, he was right, but also... they are now being punished for it. And she is as well because she knows she's undocumented. She was trying to get away before the cops realized, you know. We then see a sniper standing in a bombed out office building, ostensibly in Kosovo, and a voiceover from the character George, who is our war uh-huh. journalist. He's our war photographer, and he is Anne's long-term boyfriend. So we hear George say, in the basement of an oil mill where there was little left standing, our group includes Mark Henderson from Newsweek, myself, and a dozen KLA fighters. We see soldiers in a field. One looks down on a man's corpse. 2 days ago, we were aiming to reach Drechnica, to reach a smaller group, but those plans got changed. I've tried writing you several times. I don't know what to say. It's quiet outside. The last shots were hours ago. Waiting is the worst part. Antoine turns 5 today on May 11th, and I hope I'll be back in Paris by then. Eve promised him that he could spend the day with me. Break a leg with the play, chin up. I'm sure it'll be crap. You won't get this in time, but I'm sure you'll be good. And Allison, as the voiceover is talking, we are seeing photos, I presume are actual war photos.
War photos, yeah.
We see men and women and children. We see a body in a shallow grave. We see a man dead under, like, it looks like either a white curtain or, like, a wedding veil. Yeah. Like, someone has draped something over him. We see a woman bleeding from the mouth while two men carry her away from, assuming, an explosion. A woman's crying inside a bus or a train car, and her baby's just looking through the window because babies don't know anything.
Yeah.
A man.
Because babies don't know.
The baby's just like, I don't know this is a war. It's so sad. A man holds a cloth over another man's throat as he bleeds from his mouth. Another woman, you know, covered in blood, just looking at the camera, and her little dog is there, and his leg is blown off. You know, just groups of civilian men with guns, groups of soldiers with guns, you know, people trying to flag down hell. It's just like mayhem, you know what I mean? So just like, and then finally we see a man's foot in a shoe, and it's just the foot in the shoe and like a little bit of leg and then a pair of empty pants, and then surrounding it, sort of like, I think like blown apart are bones. So you see part of a hip bone, like horror show. And the man says, the voice says, I'm sorry for my behavior on our last day. If you see Jean, we see then another man, an older black man. He is credited as the father. He is Amadou's father. He picks up his car phone. He's a taxi driver and says, hello. What? They did. They came to get him again. I have a fare right now. Obviously, he's getting the call that Amadou had been picked up by the police. And he's like, well, how many of them came by? The police came by to their apartment. And he's like, call Asa, call Maissa, I'm on my way. We see him speed through the streets of Paris, and then his fare, who we never see, says, could you please slow down? He's like, I'm sorry, something has happened. And he's like, you know what, actually, and he pulls over and he lets the guy out. He's like, there's a taxi stand with a taxi right there, no charge. And the guy's like, the nerve! But he gets out.
It's like, you got partway for free, so.
Yeah, listen, it really worked out for you. He gets calls somebody else, Rokia, tell your mother I'm on my way. So he is on it. All of the family members are activated, and they are going to go come to Amadou's defense. We then see a room through a camcorder, which is the other non-trailer you saw.
Yes.
We see a room through a camcorder. We see a man's voice say, you can leave that there. Just dump it on the chair. I'll leave the script here as well. You know it, I hope. And the woman's voice says, of course. The man continues off camera. Great. So we won't need it. Let's just take it from after he locks her in. And steps in front of the camera.
It's a scary room.
It's a scary room. It's like, it's a beautiful wooden room, but almost like it's a home that's been abandoned for years. So it's, with a little elbow grease, it could be great again. But right now it's covered in cobwebs. There's no furniture. It's like linoleum floor. And Anne steps in front of the camera, and the man off screen says, the camera is the door. And in case you didn't get it, the camera is the door, Allison, which I do think is the thesis of this movie. The camera is the door.
I'll say that this film, which I'm already enjoying, is giving me, like, major, like, I can't believe this wasn't something I watched in a college film class.
Yes.
Or in a college, like, an English class where, like, this was, like, kind of a related text to something we were reading. It just, like, it gives me, like, so, like, I can't believe I haven't written a paper about this.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I mean, like, I guess maybe his other films that are more kind of popped off. Slightly bigger than this one, but I agree. This definitely feels like
did a lot of film study and things and a lot of writing papers about movies and books.
The man says, should I read his part? She says, yes. The man says, you think you hear the door lock. You go make sure. She walks towards the camera and tries an invisible doorknob. The man tells her, it's bolted. You'll never get out of here. And we have this great moment where it's unclear whether she is the character or she is reacting in real life, if she's Anne. And of course, then underneath that, Julia Binoche, the actual actress. And she says, excuse me? The man says, you'll never get out of here. She says, well, what do you mean? And he says, I mean, you're going to die here. Her face changes. She's like, is this a joke? She says, not for me and not for you, I'm afraid. And we sort of see her like walk away from the camera and come back. And she's like, I don't. He says, look up at the ceiling. See the base of the light fixture? And she glances up. There's a gas inlet in there and for the lighting. She's sort of like, oh, okay. And he says, see, now I asked if you had a lighter. I mean, if you had one, you could have blown us both up. She starts chewing her lips. She's like, okay, well, what do you want? It's like, I don't want anything. I have absolutely nothing against you. I like you. You just fell into my trap. And she says, well, what do you mean I've fallen into your trap? And he replies, it means you're going to die. I simply want to watch you die. Sort of relaxes and she's like, okay, you've had your fun. Okay, now let's just forget all about it. We all know that you're joking. He says, no, I'm not. Believe me. She says, I'm expected at home. I have no time for games. He says, neither do I. You hear that sound? That's from the ceiling. You'll smell it any moment. Obviously, there's gas being pumped in the room. She looks around. She starts panicking. She says, please. And she starts crying. She's like, stop this. And she starts to walk towards the camera. She's like, please let me out. He says, stop wasting my time. Show me your true face. You hate to hear it, Allison.
Ugh.
And she says, this is the only time I will speak French. She goes, quoi?
Quoi?
Ton vrai visage.
Mais c'est quoi ça? Vous voulez quoi?
Je veux voir ton vrai visage.
Which, of course, is what? And an incredible line read. She's like, well, what do you mean? What do you want? She says, I want your true face, not these tricks and lies, a real expression. Be spontaneous. React to what's happening. And she whispers, how? We then see a man, an older white farmer, as it turns out. He's eating beets at his kitchen table, looking at invoices. And it is interesting, these movies, like the templates of what I think of French people. I'm like, yes, of course, a French farmer eating beets. That is one of the French people I think of.
Absolutely like a person I've imagined before.
Yes, he has a whole loaf of delicious, crusty-looking bread. He just rips a hunk off of it. He's living that life.
God.
The door opens. We hear a voice. It is Jean. He has come back from the city. And the older man is his father, the farmer. And I love this character. Hang on, who plays the farmer? Everybody did this great. I cried. I would have cried just talking about it. He was Joseph Bärmichler. And he is great as the farmer. And Jean comes in. He says nothing, but he gets up and he gets him a plate of beets, and he wordlessly gives it to him. He's like, "Oh, he's apologizing." Oh, I'm sorry, I'm gonna cry. This movie is so. I mean, I loved all those movies, but it is funny where it's like the other movies are also very touching, but like they're also like horrifying. But they're also like
horrifying, yeah.
And this is just the touching part. So I was like, "Oh, this bastard, he's got me." He's like, well, I just have beets. That's all there is. And they eat in silence, and John doesn't say anything. And then the farmer goes, and he sits on the toilet, and he turns his face away from the camera, and he cries. And he's just sobbing on the toilet, and haven't we all been there?
Oh, God, we've all cried on a toilet before.
Yeah, but also it's like he can't say anything to his son. Like, again, he's like an elderly French farmer. I'm sure there's a million things he wish he could say, and like his son can't express it because he's raised there, and like it's not like, you know, he's been taught emotional skills. So.
Right, no, of course not.
Yeah, so we're all just, you know, in this farmhouse crying on our own separate toilets, you know, both literally and metaphorically. Allison, we see this very, like, banal scene, which I thought was also effective, where it's like we see people boarding a plane, the flight attendants like chatting with one of like the airport crew members with the vest who's gonna like close the, you know, lock the door and everything, and they're chatting, and every time a new like spate of passengers come through, sure, they sort of have to step away, and then when they get through they sort of step, and they're like, we don't hear them, we just hear the whine of the engine, but obviously they know each other, they've met a million times.
Right.
Allison, two police officers and seemingly an airline employee arrive, and they're taking the handcuffs off the woman that Jean-Pierre threw the trash on.
Yes.
The woman's name is Maria, and she is just being deported. They're putting her on a plane, and resigned because she's like, yeah, right, you got me. Like, I'm already at the airport.
I mean, I imagine there's a level of, like, in the way that, like, anytime you know that a bad outcome is a possibility, you're a little bit resigned to it mentally. Like, I have fucked up my taxes so many times that if they came and were like, you're going to jail, I'd be like, I guess I am. Like,
yeah. And obviously, well, let me look up the name of it. I'm not going to get too into our own potentially catastrophic deportations that are going to come. I not because we won't be talking about it, just sort of like it won't be happening until the new year. So I don't know.
Yeah, but I will say it's unknown kind of what the future holds for these horrific scenarios.
But I did think This American Life had a good episode, which I don't really even listen to anymore just because I listen to so many podcasts for work. Yeah. But they had an episode on November 8th called This is the Cake We Baked. And basically they're sort of like, this is the problem. With Donald Trump's victory this week, many people looked at the election results and thought, hey, yeah, this is the country I thought it was. For some people, that was a hopeful thing. For others, kind of the opposite. This week, we talk with people who will make it happen and some who are looking to what's next. And it sort of opens with like how realistic that a mass deportation would be. And J.D. Vance said at one point, and who knows what they actually are going to try to do, but like that they're going to try to deport 1 million people.
A million. A
year of his administration, if not more, which would be, I mean, that would be like literally they're just rounding up people at their jobs and at school. And
right. And yeah, it's, I was reading something where it was like, it is a lot harder to like identify if somebody is undocumented or not, but we've got a whole list of people who are immigrants here who are not citizens necessarily, like right. the Dreamers. And it's like, they're going to start, like, it's not even, ugh, it's just, it's so horrific. And I hope that not one fucking thing that they want to do can happen.
You know, and again, not to be naive about this, sort of the only thing that I helps me take the edge off is that his first, you know, I mean, to be fair, they control all of Congress, right. but that they are all themselves so disorganized and at odds with one another.
Right.
And right. I hope that there will be as much conflict as humanly possible to slow down the process of this, though, yes. God knows, whatever it's going to, like, it sort of, like, just depends on who has the power to get their agenda through first, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, because I think other people have more of an abortion cultural thing that we're working on.
Sure,
you know,
right.
Other
people. They all have different stuff, and they're all going to want their thing to go through first. So maybe it'll kind of just be like a bottlenecking, and then nothing happens. But I do hope that if anything happens, that people show up the way that they did when they tried to have a Muslim ban, and everybody flooded the airports and were there to like get in the way and stop it. Like we need to.
Yeah,
sadly,
we need to continue
that energy constantly for the next 4 years.
Yeah. But, you know, again, like depicting it as a sort of everyday thing. Nobody, everyone is used to this. This happens all the time. The flight attendants, they shut the door and the officers leave. We then see Amadou's mom, Aminate, I believe is her, I'm going to pronounce it. Aminate, she's crying. She's like, the cops came. They overturned the entire apartment. Everyone was here. They all saw it. It was so embarrassing. And we're watching her over the shoulder of a man, also black, in a suit. And he says, well, what about your son? He's like, he's a good boy. He's never done anyone any harm. He's the eldest. He helps out a lot. He is a good kid. Like, they beat and humiliated him. May Allah punish them. He did nothing wrong. They had nothing on him, so they had no choice but to let him go. But it's like they still let him go, and they still did all that stuff. You know, like, it's just horrible. And she is, and we don't, like, name, the implication is that their father is from Mali. So I wasn't sure if that meant that everyone in the family, if she was from Mali, but let's say. Right. But, and the Allah, I'm assuming they are of Muslim extraction. And then also she's basically like, I don't know what someone is bringing this on him. Like there's something on my son. I want a protection for him, which again, that is a worldwide hope that people want to have. And he's like, well, do you have anything of his? And she gives the man something wrapped in cloth that we don't see. And he sort of unwraps the cloth. Mm-hmm. We hear sort of like, almost like things clicking together, almost like, it's sort of like chess pieces or something like that, like something hard metallic clicking together. And we see him reciting something under his breath.
Okay.
And he tells her, we must never forget where we came from and who we are. We are not the sons of slaves. Your son is a proud, honest boy. His heart is pure. But he spends a lot of time with white people and someone disapproves and wants him to return. She says, return where? And he says, the home, the land of his ancestors. It's like, that's ridiculous. Who could want that? Like, that is not going to happen. So if whoever's thinking that, it's not happening. He's like, I don't know. I'm just telling you what I'm seeing. He's like, she says, you know what? I think it's the same person who bewitched Salamata, who is her younger daughter, is one of the daughters, and made her mute. What have we ever done to whoever's bringing this, like, chaos to my family? And he says, well, Salamata's affliction is different, and sort of, like, starts talking about that. But sort of, like, she is obviously in a racist country where her son is being punished by the police. So it makes sense to try to seek solace or some sort of sense of control and protection, and she's going to this guy for it. Meanwhile, we cut to Maria. Maria has been sent back to her homeland, which is Romania. And she meets back up, like, all of her family lives there. And basically what we find out is that a lot of people from her town are constantly having to go abroad undocumented to try to work and send back money.
Right.
So she, this was her, but she's back. She's only gone for 4 months. You know, she had planned to be gone longer, but like all of her grandkids are there. Her two of her daughters at least, and their kids are, or one of the daughters isn't married, but like her daughter's sons are there. So they're thrilled to see her. They're like, oh, we weren't planning on seeing you again. But like when a boy sort of like takes her hand, is walking, is talking about like how great mobile phones are. Two of the cousins deliver the calf. Uncle Nilu was able to call them on his cell phone and give them instructions from Rome. He's like, do you have a mobile phone? Can I see it? Do you have games on it?
Yeah.
And she's like, well, I don't. When I call home, I used a public phone. He's like, oh, okay. Well, you should definitely get a cell phone. She's like, all right, I'll let you know when I do. And they're sort of walking along a construction site or like a salt storage field because there's like this white dust billowing. I think it's like, I don't know what you call that, like a salt factory where like they move the salt around.
Yeah, like, it's just like
in a warehouse.
Yeah.
So, but it's sort of billowing around, sort of obscuring her. And she turns and she hears a man call Maria and she sees her husband. He sort of like walks through the dust and she grabs him and she's like feeling his arms to make sure he's real and she hugs him. And his name is Dragos. And she pulls him into her embrace. That night, we see Anne. She's ironing in front of the TV and she hears screaming in the next apartment. And she shuts off the TV and it sounds like a mother and a father screaming at a little girl. And it's like, you know, sort of seems like it's escalating. She listens, not knowing if she should call, what to do. She continues to iron and the screaming ends. So she's kind of like, oh, well, I guess it's okay. We're back in Romania. The little boy and his mother, Irina, who is Maria's daughter, walk Maria through their home, their building. So all of the homes in their village are like half built. So because they can kind of only like build them while money comes in with like whoever's abroad, like whoever's getting work.
Right.
But it's sort of like obviously a sign of success, a sign of like that they're doing well as a family, that they're building this new house. Things are coming along and she says, oh, you missed this big funeral from this like big wig. There must have been 300, 400 people there. Some came all the way from Cluj, which is how we figured out we were in Romania because I looked it up. And Irina said, I mean, he was an important man. And Dragos says, oh, they all think they're important. And Irina says, well, we should just throw the old man in a hole. Should we do that with you? And Maria says, Irina. And I thought that was just, the line read is so funny. Like, oh, I'll just throw you in a hole. Okay. And it's like, look, you have to respect people's work. Like he, you know, he worked his way up. He's really important. All these people came based on like how successful he was, you know? And she says, do you think Nuta and Niku like their father being abroad? So her husband is also abroad, also working. You know, obviously like different members of the family keep having to go abroad and then coming back. And she says, Mama, look at this. And she looks at the apartment, like where her room would be. It's gorgeous. But again, nothing in there. And they do have a couch covered in plastic. And Maria's like, oh, that's really nice. And she asks one of the granddaughters, do you like it? She says, I do, but I wish we had some armchairs. And Dragos is like, oh, she's got delusion of grandeur. We got a couch, but we don't have armchairs. And she's like, I didn't mean it like that. And they talk about the house being finished before the wedding. And it's like, oh, well, Soren's house is mostly complete. And they're talking about like finishing it. He's like, and look, if it doesn't work out, Florica can have the house and then she might even find a man. And his daughter goes, are you drunk, Papa? Like just like zigging me in front of everyone.
What a welcome home.
Yeah, it's just great. We see a class full of kids drumming. So they're all drumming as their teachers like hype them up and instruct them. And it's sort of like marching band style drumming with all these different children. We see George in his photojournalist vest for all of his like a photo accoutrement. He returns to the apartment from Kosovo and he starts opening up his mail. He calls his boss, Jackie, and says, I'll be in at 10 tomorrow. How do the pictures look? You know, just sort of like getting ready to publish some of them. The door opens and Anne is home and they hang up and she like looks at him from the doorway and he looks from the window and they sort of have this like, good morning. And the phone rings and there's no one there. And she's like, ah, I should have let it go to the voicemail. She hangs up and she strokes George's beard and says, hello, you. And they have a nice reunion. Mm-hmm. We see the farmer. Oh, God, this made me cry, too. We see the farmer. Because the farmer's like, okay, I can't speak my emotions, but I can at least maybe try to give Jean something to make him stay, you know?
Okay.
So he opens the back of his van and he got him this beautiful dirt bike. And it is sick, right?
Yeah.
And he goes to get Jean, and he goes
kind of
to
the height of dirt biking, like 2000. This was like exactly when they were like at the peak of making it appealing.
And he goes to Jean. He goes into the barn, and then Jean comes out, and he's thrilled. and he jumps on the dirt bike and he starts driving around. And because it's a Michael Haneke movie, I'm like, well, he didn't have a helmet. I'm like, well, he's going to be immediately paralyzed.
I know. God.
And we see him just racing down the road. Allison, we see Anne is in the movie she auditioned for. She got the part.
Oh.
She looks fabulous, all white. The Michael Haneke knows that Julia Binoche looks fabulous in white.
Yeah, she really does.
And she's walking through this gorgeous, gigantic French home, like huge ceilings, fireplace, with an older, well-dressed man, the realtor. And there's also like the camera crew and the sound guy. They're sort of like hustling backward as they walk through this gorgeous home. And we also see the camera crew and the sound guy sort of hustling in front of them as they enter this room. And unfortunately, it is the music room, Allison. And Anne's character says, huh, it's strange. This room has no windows and such strange light fixtures. He's like, oh, yes, the windows have been paneled over for acoustics, I assume. You know, you can't even hear cars on the street. And she goes to open a second doorway. The door is locked. And he says, ah, that's the hallway to the stairs. The key's been lost, but I can see if I can get a new one made. He pulls out a cigarette and lighter, and he offers her one. And she says, oh, I don't smoke. And he's like, unfortunately, I do. He starts to flick his lighter, and it's dead. And he says, do you have one? She says, no. He's like, well, let me just step out and locate my briefcase. And I'll be right there. Allison, we see her turn and open what she assumes is a closet. And inside is just a concrete wall.
Yeah.
And behind her, we hear the click of the door. And she whirls around. She's been locked in. And we hear the director say, she can't look directly into the camera. We then back up a scene. We see the scene. They recorded the scene before in the room before. Again, stunning French home. She's looking out the back of the home.
Feels like... this is a movie that we should be doing for the pod.
Yes, 100%. The realtor killer. Home, death, home. He's like, you know, everything has been completely upgraded. The floor has been revarnished. He's like, everything's been redone, but it's all the originals. And it's like, well, that's great. He's like, again, we have a fantastic acoustics in the music room. Why don't you come on in and check them out? We then see Jean and the father feeding all of their cows, which I'm assuming are dairy cows, and they're so cute.
Oh, I love cows.
They're so sweet. They're like just big dogs.
They are.
George and Anne go to dinner with all their friends at this like hopping restaurant, and she explains the plot of the movie she's in. She's like, the inspector starts linking the crimes and building a psychological profile of the killer, made easier by the fact his personality is very similar to the realtor. And they're like, oh, what happens to you? And she says, I can't say. That would ruin the surprise. And one of the men was like, hey, are you happy to be back? Is it weird? He's like, well, I have a stack of expense reports I have to file, which I'm not thrilled about. And he's like, oh, really? That's it? He's like, well, I'll be honest. Like, the thing of it is like, life here is more complicated. Like, once you get at your bearings there, things are very black and white. It's very easy to, like, just know what to do. But here you have to just adjust to sort of like life is hard. Life is like this ongoing complicated problem. They talk about their friend Martin. He and his wife Julie are getting divorced. She left with the kids. Another friend stops by to see then a couple. And it's sort of like all these people like welcoming him back and catching him up while he's sort of obviously still getting used to, if he can, being back in Paris. We see another couple walk in. It's Amadou with a date who is white. Okay. And he was telling the story of how his father came to the country.
Okay.
And basically his father was on a boat. And
from Mali?
From Mali. Okay. No, I think he's from Mali because he says he met this other guy from Mali. So I'm like, okay, that must mean he's from Mali.
Implies they both, yeah.
Yes. So using that logic, we see he's like, well, he was coming in and the captain had taken his passport and was basically like, using it to force him to do labor on the boat. And in order to get his passport back for the captain's like, you have to prove to me that you have a job. You know, I'm not just going to let you out here. And but luckily he met this other guy, and the other guy from Mali has had a job lined up. And he's like, you know what? I can go and talk to my boss and see if he'll hire you just like for however much just to get you off the boat. Mm-hmm. He's like, thanks so much. But the captain said, this guy could take your passport to the boss and get like the paperwork, but you have to stay here on the boat because I don't want you tricking me. Even though it's like that is obviously illegal and like you can't, you know, keep him there.
Right.
But I'm going to force you to stay for security and this guy has to come back. Meanwhile, I'm sure his dad's like, well, I hope this guy doesn't just steal my passport, but I don't know what else to do because I'm trapped on a boat. Meanwhile, Amadou's date is like wrapped by this. Like she's like completely engrossed in this story. And they get to their table, and he's like, you know, I reserved a window seat for us. And the waiter says, let me check. He goes to check. And she sort of keeps fiddling with her watch. And there was this little bit that I didn't know what to take from it, but a little bit of work where he's like, do you like that watch? And she's like, I don't know. What do you think? He's like, I think it's so-so. And she does this very funny kind of French move where she just pulls off her watch and she puts it in the ashtray. And then when
it's like the most French thing I've ever heard.
I know. I was like, huh. And it looked like a perfectly normal, like, women's leather wristwatch you would wear at the turn of the century. And the waiter comes back and is like, I'm really sorry. You are too late. We gave it away. It's 8:15. Your reservation was for 7:30. Couldn't keep it. And he's like, oh, that's fine. We'll stay right here. This seems fine. And the waiter goes to wipe off wipe off the table. And he pulls the watch out of the ashtray thinking it's her. You know, here it is. You must have done this accidentally. And the woman goes, oh, that's not ours. And she and Abdu like look at each other like, oh, we're playing a fun French game. I was like, okay, well, that must be a French thing.
I guess.
The guy says, oh, well, okay, it's behind the bar if somebody comes back, if, you know, they left it here. And she keeps sort of like, every time he comes over, she's like, tell me more of the story. Tell me more of the story. Like, get out of here. And she orders a strawberry cocktail that Amadou doesn't drink, so he gets a Perrier. And so he's like, so my father's there. And my father says, I need to get off this boat. And he realized that he's going to try, there's a boat dock next to the boat, and he's going to try to shimmy across the gangway to just get onto the next boat and try to escape. Mm-hmm. And she's completely gross. And then she starts playing with her wrist without the wristwatch. Like, she's, like, playing with a phantom wristwatch.
Yeah.
And he says, so my father put on 2 pairs of pants. He put on as many shirts as he could fit. And he had to sneak past the captain's room. And he always kept his door wide open to try to catch people leaving his nightmare boat.
Yeah, his prison ship.
And wouldn't you believe it, he is able to sneak across the gangway and get onto the boat. And he takes her arm, and she, like, she can't even, like, engage them. He takes her arm, and he kisses her wrist. But he's like, so what happens? It's like, oh, he got out. He got out, and when he got to shore, the man was waiting there with his passport and a job. Can you believe it? She's like, that's insane.
Wow.
And just then, we see Anne come out of the bathroom and see Amadou with his date and recognize that he was the guy that was fighting with Jean.
Yes.
And she returns to George's side as their friends chit-chat, and he's in a fight with their friend Francine. And we don't find out until later sort of what they're fighting about, but basically the idea of, like, the value of photographing war, or, like, more okay. I think broadly, like, can you really depict something via an image that can really convey something? Like,
yeah.
And, you know, he's like, Francine, I understand what you're saying. We were talking about two different things. Like, for you, this is a theoretical question. For me, I was there. And I do think that we're obligated to, like, try to convey what was happening. And she says, but you can't really convey it in your photos. And then she says, well, then what's the point? And it's like, okay, sure, I guess
theoretically. Well, then what's the point of anything?
Of anything. Exactly. I was like, well, images, I mean, like, yes, obviously you could make horrible, like, unhelpful, salacious images of horrific events, and that would be unhelpful. But, like, Vietnam, like, the idea that, like, oh, what's the point of photographing something? Well, so that people can hopefully learn.
Yeah.
Like, people can look at what we're capable of and be like, we have to stop doing this.
Even if you can't capture the entire lived experience of the people and place you're depicting, like, even if it's a sliver of it, it still seems helpful. Like,
yeah, I just don't agree.
The all or nothing idea of, like, if you can't perfectly convey the experience of being in a place, why would you ever use an image of it, is the dumbest. That's such a, like, ugh, like a contrarian argument.
And to me, and this is, like, no offense if anyone's an academic, but to me, like, that is, like, an academic argument that kind of, like, I don't know, it's almost like, okay, so we just don't do anything? Like, it's almost like cuts off the ability to be like, well, some of these images were helpful. Some of them were used for propaganda. Some of them were art. Some of them actually, like, got into a newspaper and people understood what was going on. You know what I mean? Like, that all of these images could be helpful or not, or that they exist sort of in relationship to one another. And they do talk about it later, the concept of the ecology of the image. I'm just going to read Google's definition. Concept that examines the complex relationships between images, considering them as part of a larger interconnected system. I think, again, we're trying to make this is about, like, art and film and depiction, and also the fact that the world is interconnected. So obviously it's like, how do we represent all of, like, human life And also while we're making a movie where I, the filmmaker, are trying to make that, you know? Yes. So I, again, an interesting way to explore it. And also it's like, wow, Francine, you seem like a real good hang.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, what's the point? What's the point of you, bitch?
Yeah, go home.
Why do you get out of here, Francine?
What's the point of you, bitch?
Get out of my fucking face. Also, what do you do?
Yeah. Yeah. What are you contributing?
Yeah, Francine. And Anne says, oh, great, I went to the bathroom. Now you're back on your favorite topic. So I guess George and Francine are constantly arguing about this. And I'm like, why do you hang out with Francine?
Yeah, just stop hanging out with her. Cut her out of your life.
And Francine says, well, if I can't deal with my friends, then who can I? And I wrote, man, shut up, Francine. Shut up. No, but I think it's like, that's fine. Like, I think, like, if you want to have an argument about this, I don't have it with this guy who just got back from Kosovo. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, maybe a couple of months from now, I think you can get into it. But it's like, this guy, based on the photos we've seen, horrific events.
Yes.
That the world should know happened. You know what I mean?
Like, and saw it and you didn't. So you actually can't weigh in on if this image is accurately conveying anything. Because you only know the image. You don't, like, he, like,
and also obviously that, like, he's someone who could leave and come back, which is also like that affects the images versus if you live there. And you know, but again, like, you have to have the conversation versus being a real Francine about it.
Yeah, I've been a real Francine.
Anne nudges George and has him turn around and say, don't turn around right now. But it's that black guy that hassled John. Don't let him see you looking. And then George just fully turns around and looks. People do this all the time.
I'm
like always like, hey, don't turn around right now. But that person, yada, yada. Right. People turn around. I was like, what is happening in your brain?
I literally just said it.
I am setting you up for success. And now you're going to turn around and make direct eye contact with this person. Oh, but you already did it.
Yeah.
Allison, at this point, what would you do?
What would you do?
I mean,
I also think you could pick any character. You don't have to be
I guess, like, not engaging with the man from the altercation with I'm now blanking on his name.
Amadou. But yeah, it's like, what are you going to go yell at him at the restaurant? Like, what are you talking about?
It happened. It's over. You didn't have all the information. Like, just keep living your life and let him live his.
And also, like, that she seeks no further understanding of that interaction, right? Like, she presumes, like, he attacked Jean rather than, like, Jean did not seem to be willing to cop to having done anything.
Right.
Which I again, like, whose view of this? Like, she has a one-sided idea.
Also, if I'm George, I'm cutting off my friendship with Francine.
Yes. Great. I think that's perfect.
Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
We find ourselves in a car traveling down a road in Romania, which, by the way, like, is beautiful. And I think, like, they depicted it as, like, a beautiful country. And we're listening to the radio, and the car guy in the car spots Maria, pulls over. He's like, oh, my God, you're back already. And she says, Mahai Papa, how are you doing? I don't know if that's a nickname, if he is somebody's papa, but I love that was his name. He says, well, I'll drive you the rest of your way home. She hops in. She's, like, carrying a bag. He's like, I just got back a week ago. Maria's like, oh, I've been here a couple weeks already. He's saying that Mariella is a nanny for a couple of doctors in Dublin. She's there. Everything seems to be going well. I just came back to do the shearing for the season. So to help shear the sheep, and then I'm back at it.
Sure.
And he says, well, how is Paris? Did you find work? And, of course, she is, like, even within this situation, like, too proud, you know? Like, she's like, oh, yeah, I've got a good job at a school, actually. And he's like, oh, a school job? That's wonderful. Like, how long were you there? She says, 4 months. And then she says, because I miss the kids. So, again, it's like, even within people, like, who know the stakes, there is still the stigma about being deported,
yes,
which
of
I
course.
Thought was really hard. Where it's just like, oh God, like it's like of all the people would understand is these people, and even then you're like, there's I don't want to say the cops arrested me and put me on the plane.
Yeah.
So he drops her off, and he says the house looks great. It's really coming along. When's the wedding again? She says, oh, the wedding is in the spring. And he's like, oh, are you going to this other wedding? She's like, well, I got to ask Dragos. And he says, well, if there's drinking, Dragos will be there. So I'll plan to see you there. Okay.
Okay.
And then he drives on, and again, all the houses are half built, but like are clearly being built, you know, in piecemeal as money comes in. Back at home, outside the door, Anne finds a note outside her apartment. She calls George's office to find him. He's out, and neither Natalie nor Jackie, his boss, know where he'll be back. And she looks at the piece of paper. We are not shown the paper, and it drives me insane when they do
that. Oh, my God. Show us papers.
She goes across the hallway and knocks on the door, and she meets elderly Mrs. Becker, her across the way neighbor. And she says, do you know who wrote this? Did you write this note? And she's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I wouldn't have written a note like that. I would have just come talk to you. And it says, are you sure? Can you at least read it and tell me what you think? And she says, I don't have my glasses. Also, what are you talking about?
Right.
What are you asking me? And she's like, never mind. You can go back inside your apartment. And goes back to her apartment. Aminu's mother talks animatedly with the man she met previously. And she said she's having all of these nightmares. And she sort of hasn't been feeling well. She's having migraines. She's like, you know, I'm having these sort of lights and like their shapes. They look like they're coming through the wall. And in my dreams, I can see them coming towards the house. They're banging on the door. They're scratching at the door. Mm. And the door bangs open. And I wake up and I try to stand. I cannot. And I scream and I pray to Allah. And as I'm praying, I hear a sound behind me. And I scream so loud, my husband Yosef wakes up and he turns on the light. And there's nobody there. Like I felt like I heard the laugh, but he's nobody there. He's like, okay, so that's where the migraine started. She says, that's exactly right. And the guy says, well, you know, what did the white doctor say? She's okay. Like, listen, I took the pills. Amadou and his friends, they brought me something. I took that. I'm past that. I'm not talking about that.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Allison, the farmer, finds a note from Jean. He has left.
Oh.
Probably on his sick-ass fucking dirt bike. He says.
I'm leaving on a dirt bag.
I mean, I'm a dirt bag. I'm leaving on a dirt bike. The note reads, dear Papa, I can't stay here any longer. Please don't try to find me, Sean.
Oh.
And the farmer puts it down. He turns and he just lights the stovetop and starts cooking for the day.
Oh. Sad.
Doesn't even go cry in the toilet. At the grocery store, Anne has a total freak out over the note. And George remains calm, which makes her even more upset. They're in the yogurt aisle, which, of course, is France. So there's so many yogurts in this yogurt aisle.
So much yogurt there.
Yogurts we hadn't even heard of over here. Anne says, it couldn't have been the little girl. She wouldn't have signed it a defenseless child. A 10-year-old girl wouldn't have written that, and it wasn't a child's handwriting. And he's like, okay, so it must be the neighbor, because who else would it be? She says, what would I do? He's like, well, we could either go talk to her or go talk to the actual kid's parents. Or we go to the police. I'm open to whatever. And he's like, oh, we're going to talk to them. Oh, hi. Right. Do you beat your child? Do you abuse your daughter? Why is she always screaming? And George makes a huge mistake where they're in the wine aisle now. And he goes, Chablis or Sincere? And she's like, are you even listening to me? I don't give a fuck. You don't care about anything.
No, obviously, yogurt and wine. So
it's all dairy. It's all wine. And obviously, like, this is bringing up stuff that's from their relationship, which is that she thinks that he's uncaring. And he also probably does feel a distance having just been away.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, you wash your hands of this life. He's like, look, I wasn't here. I didn't hear the crying. I didn't know anything about this. And then he makes mistakes. He's like, well, this isn't my problem. She's like, well, it's going to be your problem. And he says, look, the only options for who wrote the note, it's the parents, the girl herself, which we don't think it is, or the neighbor who already said she didn't. So I don't know what you want me to do. I will support whatever you want to do. She's like, you could help me. And an elderly woman pushes her cart past them down the yogurt aisle. Or down the wide aisle. And she's like, you know what? You just always run away, just like you did with your son. If you remember, he talks about, in the initial voiceover, he talks about seeing his son turning 5 and getting to have him for the day.
Yeah.
And so obviously he has a son, he has an ex. And he's like, oh, of course you'd say that to me. You say it to me all the time. You sound like a broken record. Which again, if this is the fight you're having all the time, this does not seem good. This does not seem like a fight that is going to lead to a sustainable relationship.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Meanwhile, as they're fighting, they're putting in, like, Diet Coke, bottled water. Like, it's almost like a Costco or like a super, like it's some gigantic grocery. There's like aisle after aisle and they're filling their cart with them. Again, plenty, so much, so much.
Yes.
But they're still having their, you know, fights arguments and like everything of their normal life. And she says, well, what if I was pregnant? He's like, what are you saying? What do you mean? Are you pregnant? And she tells him, I had an abortion while you were gone. And she says it right as a woman's looking past, like going past them. And she goes and says, do you mind? And yells at this woman. Like, she's going so wide with it. And she says, have you ever made anyone happy? Have
Jesus
you ever
Christ.
Made, I know. Have you ever made a single person happy in your life? And George looks at her and goes, no. Oh. And she runs up and she hugs him from behind and then they start kissing passionately next to the formula. And I was like, is this what being French is? But maybe just being straight. I can barely remember anymore. And they kiss and they walk out in the grocery store. We see back in Romania, Maria and her family, and looks like everyone they know is at the wedding. It's fun. There's like all these multicolored streamers hanging from the ceiling. There's like a lineup of like great grandmas and great aunts and babushkas looking on. We see Dragos and Maria, they're holding hands and sort of dancing in a circle with everybody, sort of snaking around the room. We see back in Paris, the father yells at Amadou's younger brother, Dimba, as Aminate and their four other siblings look on. So this is a big family. There's also a grandma. I'm presuming the dad's mom is there.
Okay.
And there was some incident at school. And Aminate says, you're going to believe the teacher over your own son. So obviously she's on Dimba's side. Apparently a mother told the teacher that she caught her son smoking weed and said that Dimba gave it to him. Dimba's like 10 years old, right? And is already sobbing, like is really upset. And I'm going to say, yeah, they said it was because he's the only black child in that class. Obviously, that's why he's got blamed for it. But then the grandma leaps in and starts blaming Amadou because he's a bad influence because he hangs out with all those white girls all the time. And Amadou's like, what did I do?
Yeah, right. How am I a part of this?
They start then going at it like, don't you tell me what to do with my kids. It's like, well, obviously you need to be told, you know, like what to do with your kids. A classic grandma-mom fight. The father takes Dimba down to sits in the kitchen table and says, I just want you to be truthful with me. And Dimba again is 10 years old. He's crying. And he said, Francois took his coat and he said he would give it back if I gave him 100 francs. And he threw my coat on the ground. He stomped on it. And he said, if I didn't bring the 100 francs the next day, I wouldn't even recognize my coat. And that's it. That's what he said.
Oh.
And he's like, well, where do you expect to get the money from? And he said, Francois said I'd have to steal it from home. He has my jacket. I didn't give him the money because I wasn't going to do that. So I think because of that, he got mad and he blamed me when his mom caught him. He just hates me. And that's probably like he's black. You know what I mean? He's like, he's just picking on him. And the father says, is that the truth? And Dimba says, yes. Back at home, we see Greg fixing his war camera. He sort of like puts it on like a strap. So it's hanging on his chest.
Okay.
And then he has a cord running down so he could click the shutter from like a...
With one hand,
little,
yeah.
A little remote in his hand. And he sits in front of a mirror and he faces it, like a full-length mirror, and he presses the button and the screen goes black and we hear a bang and the sound of a body heavily hitting the ground.
Ooh.
Allison, who will survive this film?
Survive.
I mean, I hope everyone. This feels like I don't really know what's going on in the current scene, like what we'll, you know, turn and see. I'm going to guess everyone survives.
Okay, great.
I want everyone to make it.
And then let's see, who's going to end up back in Paris? Who do we think? Do we think Maria's making it back there?
I don't think Maria.
Okay. What about George? Is he going to stay? Our war photographer?
I think he's going to stay. Yeah.
Okay. What about Amadou? Is he going to stay?
Yes.
Okay. What about sort of George and the farmer?
And the farmer. I think the farmer is going to continue his farm life without, was it Jean?
Without Jean. Okay. And then finally, where do we think Anne? What's going to happen with Anne? Do we still think that she's is she going to try everything else out the part? What's going to happen with her career?
I feel like her and George are going to split up. I feel like this relationship might not be long for this world.
There is a lot of fights that people have all over and over again.
Of course.
Those fights should not be that fight. I feel very confident saying that.
Yes.
That if that's where the fight ends up going every time, it's just
then weird. This is not it. This is not, yeah. Because, like, you could have a little, like, ugh, we always argue, and it becomes about, like, well, you know, you haven't done, like, X, Y, Z. But, like, this fight, if this is the point that it continues to get to, like,
yeah.
Either resolve this or, like, break up.
Yeah.
Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume. Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Allison, we when the screen, when we return to the screen, we see what the bang and the body falling to the ground was, which is the farmer has killed a cow. Allison, he has killed all the cows. And I don't know if he used a gun or like a bolt gun, a like bolt you kill gun, cattle with, but it's in his hand, but he like locks it back into a metal box and he starts smoking a cigarette, but he's killed all of the cows. I was like, ooh, I get it, but you didn't want to at least sell them? Like, I understand you're like, fuck it, I'm torching it, but like, ooh, you probably didn't have to kill all of them.
Yeah.
We have this great scene of Anne auditioning on stage, and she's laughing maniacally while giving this incredible performance. Hang on, which Shakespearean play? Yeah. Where's Malvolio? Oh, Twelfth Night, okay.
Oh, Twelfth Night.
Yes, so it's a monologue from Twelfth Night. And she says, if you desire the spleen and will laugh yourself into stitches, then follow me. Malvolio has come to court my lady in yellow tights, cross-guarded most villainously. I've dogged him like his murderer. And she's just clowning on Malvolio. And she's great. Like, she's absolutely crushing. Yeah, yeah. And we're watching her from behind the director, the casting director, probably the producers at the back of the theater. They are dead silent. And then when she's done, they kind of like whisper amongst themselves. And she goes, anyone out there? No reply. Back at Amadeus. Oh, this scene's really great, too. Back at Amadeus' house. Like, he's talking to Salamata, his younger sister, who, again, she's got to be 8. She's the one who is mute, and her mother was talking about, like, she's been bewitched, she's mute, something is happening, somebody is, like, has this malevolent intent for her family, and also, you know, to conceptualize it as such, it's like, obviously Salamata is incredibly traumatized being a child having to immigrate and then, like, live in a racist country, and, like, you know, it makes complete sense, but she is signing, so I think we're to realize, she's part of the sort of signing we saw at the beginning, like, so she is...
Okay.
There's no implication that she's deaf, but that she is mute, so she's had to learn sign language.
Right.
And so she's siding with Amadou, who can speak to her, and is, like, being very kind to her and trying to explain. Allison, the father has left. The father has left and gone back to Molly.
Oh, wow.
So I it's not clear what happened, and I think we're supposed to think, like, it was really abrupt. So I don't know, if he just left, if he was caught and deported.
It was against his own decision. Yeah.
Exactly. We don't know. And everyone's, like, sort of working out all of their, like, really upset emotions while Salamata is signing, and like her questions appear at the bottom during the conversation with like the slightly older kids and the mom. Is she's signing stuff like, where did he go? How will he get there? Will he be alone? It's so sad. But also, like, a child's like, what do you mean? Like, what are you talking about?
Right. Well, where is he?
Well, through what conveyance? What is that? How far away is it? Like, having no idea. The like teenage sister, she's really upset, and she's like, he's not coming back. He's going to get a new wife half my age, and he's going to start a new family and we're never going to see him again, which like obviously it has happened, I'm sure. But also it's like she's just sort of like trying to create some sort of like wall between her emotional reaction that like he's gone. You know what I mean? He's like, well, he's not coming back. He's going to have another family. Her mom starts yelling at her like to respect her father. They, like they're going back and forth and it's like, well, you know what happened with Uncle Aki? He went, he left 3 years ago. He never came back and now he's just living there. Don't pretend like dad's not going to do that, you know? And then we see Sal about it, like saying like, it, you know, sort of like, well, could you tell me more? Like what's happening? And Abdu says he's far away, but his brother is there and we have other family, so he won't be alone. And it's so sad. And she says, but where is he going? No. And Abdu says he's going to Africa. And Salamita says, where's Africa? And it's like, right, like she was probably a baby when they came there. Like she doesn't have any connection to it. And she's trying to be like, could somebody tell me baseline information of what's happening? And then the other kids probably were born there and came over and like, you know, are at least he has an ID. So like, I don't know how it works if you're a naturalized citizen or how it works. But they're legally. And so it's like, oh, hey, just, you know, I'm a baby and I don't have any context of what's going on. And it was just so heartbreaking. We see George on the train and he is sort of like taking people's portraits, like while sitting across them. The thing is he's doing it in a way where it's like, because he's like looking at them and trying to frame this, it seems creepy. Like he's staring at this woman and has his camera pointed at her. And you do hear the shutter click and she gets up. And so this woman's like, okay, a guy just like watching me. And I think the idea is sort of like, can you stop looking at the world through a lens once you've started? Yes. Right. And it's like, okay, well, now you're just recording people. And another woman sits down. He sort of assesses her, right? Like he's looking up and down where like, in her mind, it's like, oh, are you just checking me out? You're doing this like sort of a weirdly obvious way.
Right.
Versus, and it's like, is it any better if he's assessing her for an artistic purpose? I don't know. Back in Romania, this guy stops by to talk to Maria and Irina. And he says, hey, me and it would be six with you. So, but me and a couple other people are going to try to head back to Paris. And Irina's like, I mean, if you're going to do it, mom, this is a good opportunity. Yeah. And she says, well, I did talk to Drogos. And they're standing, it's like, there's beautiful garden behind their house that's, like, being built. And, like, you know, they just all this, like, the wedding and, like, they got to be together. Yeah. But also it's like, yeah, some of us have to go somewhere. We just have to be doing this. And Maria's like, well, I don't think that he'll mind. You see Maria's like, yeah, I'm probably going to have to go do that. Back at the farm, George and Anne go to visit, having heard that John left. And the farmer says, you know, I honestly thought he was going to get married someday and take the farm. And he's like, well, why did Francois call you? And George's like, well, he was worried. I think he heard about Jean and, well, all the cattle and stuff. And the farmer hates that people were, like, talking about him, which is also like, sir, they are it's good to have people concerned about you. Like, to shut people out entirely, it's like, well, yes, you will hate it because they're paying attention to you and they want to try to come be here with you.
Right.
And he's like, well, Francois should be happy. Now, his livestock, he'll get more money from it. It's like, yeah, again, why did you do that? But obviously he's expressing some distress in this, like, really awful way. And George says, well, do you know where Jean is now? He's like, how should I know? I'm not going to look for him. Aww. You know? And obviously the farmer's devastated, but he can't let show that at all.
Right, yeah. That emotion is locked real tight.
Yeah. And he's like, well, I'm too busy to go running off. And, you know, if he wants to come back, he can. But he chose to do that. And now, at least if he went to Paris, he doesn't have to get up at 5 in the morning. That's what you city folk don't do that, right? You set a fine example. And then George sort of looks down. And at least the farmer's like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. And he's just sort of like, he really is trying his best, even though he did kill all the scouts for no reason.
Yeah.
And then there's this great scene where it's like, do you want something to eat? And it's like, yeah, anytime something happens, he's like, well, I can at least make food, right? Which I think a lot of people's impulse of like, I don't know where to put this emotion, but can I make you something to eat? But he can't say like, no, I can't. I'm not touched with my emotions, but I can make beets. So please let me do that. Please, I have to make beets. They're like, no, because they're like, no, we're not going to make, you know, your father will make food. And he's like, no, please just let me do that. And eventually he sits down and he's like, well, how's your career going? And she tells about the thriller. He's like, well, you have to write me the title when it's finished. I'll go see it. And she's like, yeah, I think it's going to be called The Collector. And, you know, George said, are you going to try to look for Jean at some point? And the farmer's like, look, he left 6 weeks ago. If he wants to come back, he knows where this place is. And Anne touches the farmer's hand, and that's too much. And he stands up and he like excuses himself. Like he can't handle the affection. No. We see a group of immigrants, including Maria, climb up into a, I thought it was the rafters of a train, but it could be the rafters of a boat. But they're like climbing up into the roof of something where like a, like sort of like the panel will be placed over it. There's like, you know, six of them.
Behind them?
Sort of above. So they're like up in the rafters of some kind of either a train car or a boat headed back to France. And we then see a funeral for the girl. And I didn't realize whose funeral it was because everyone's name is either Francois or France. Like there are different variations. So I was like, oh, are we talking about the guy who was the at the farm? No, it is a funeral for the little girl who lived in Anne's building, who we don't have any other information except it sure seems like she was murdered by her parents.
Jesus.
And she's there with Mrs. Becker, who is crying and her nose is running the entire time. And neither of them speak because they're so horrified.
Yeah.
And we see everyone's devastated. They scoop a little piece of, like a little bit of dirt from like a golden bowl with a little trowel and they throw it on the grave.
Yeah.
And again, that could be wrong, but that was my interpretation of what was going on. And we get no other explanation, but we see Anne is really devastated and I'm assuming blaming herself and perhaps blaming George, which is not fair, but I think it's like that was part of their argument of like she wanted him to tell her what to do in some ways and he wouldn't do it. And I think that was sort of him, his sort of as a war journalist, like sort of like, I'm not going to make that decision. That's not my role. You have to decide and I'll help you do it. And she was so enraged that she had to make the decision. And now she's sort of having to experience like, well, I guess I made the wrong decision because I should have called somebody. I should have called the cops. I should have figured that out. But again, it's you didn't know. And also, again, how much can you blame yourself? But we see then George's voiceover of his subway photos, which are stunning, right? They're gorgeous. Yeah. You know, he's like, look, you know, it's easy to talk about the ecology of the image, which I just looked it up, is a Susan Sontag premise. And basically, Susan Sontag was cute because the premise of the concept of the ecology of the image is that she's basically like, we should not be flooding everyone with all these junk images. Like, if you're creating an image, it should be with intent. God. It should be purpose. It should be a piece of art. And I was like, oh, well, she wouldn't like where we're at now with AI.
Yeah, you'd hate Instagram.
Right, just like, again, minions being crucified. I you know, look, she wouldn't care for it, I imagine. And we see these beautiful photographs. And he talks about being captured by the Taliban when he was in Afghanistan. And one of the Taliban fighters was like, oh, you're French. And then he sort of like pretends to slit his throat like, oh, you know what we do with you guys. But then this guy was replaced 2 days later with another person. And the guy says, in English, what can I do for you? And George is like, oh, thank God. Like, he's like, I'm a journalist. I'm not with the Americans. I am not in any way a combatant. We're here to take photographs. Yeah. If you just let us make a phone call, I'm with a guy here from CNN. They'll get us out of here. We do not mean to be a problem for you. And when he stops, the guy says, what can I do for you? And he realized like, oh, that's the only English phrase you had. But in that moment, it was like, that's what I needed. And I was like,
relief.
And I was hearing this, the context was such that I was like, you know, and eventually one of the guys did get CNN to get them out. But he says like, that's, you know, I don't want to admit to Francine that I do think about these things. It's easy to talk about like, you know, ecology of the image. And he says the value of the non-transmitted message. And he says, which I think is like, I think, again, a thesis of the movie is like, what are the consequences of the images you depict? Like, it's one thing to be like, well, I just make it and people interpret it, which is like kind of, I guess, like how also we got like AI in general, where it's like, well, it's none of my business what the consequences are. It's like, well, I guess everyone should be thinking about the consequences of all of this because nobody is, right? Or not enough people are thinking about that. And he's sort of it's like, well, she's not wrong that those are, I don't know. It's like you think about it and it's like, how do you understand that? What can you do? He's like, I just think that she's saying it not because it's true, but because she just doesn't want to be bothered. Like it's easier to think that. It's easier to be like, well, what's even the point? Because then it doesn't ask anything of you. But then he says, I don't think I'm cut out for peacetime or whatever you call this. You know, it's not peacetime, but it's away from the war. I don't think I could be here, you know? And they end with, like, we were in Kabul and people were very polite, but they were weary and not that I could blame them. And I think it's just sort of like, once you've been in those situations, it's like polite but weary is the only thing you could do rather than sort of what I imagine you saying is like sort of the Western world where it's like, well, what's even the point? I'll just remove myself entirely. It's like, well, that's a fiction too. And
Yep.
We see the migrants with Maria. They're hanging out. They're at, like, it seems like they're in like an abandoned school, or they're in some place where they're, you know, sort of like temporary digs while they've all arrived. But they're drinking. They're like glad to be back in Paris. They're smoking. They're talking. She's talking to another woman. And they're like, oh, does anyone know who has Lenuza's work card? Because basically they're like, we all kind of look alike. We're all like 50-something-year-old women from Romania. They're not going to look that hard on him.
We could interchangeably, yeah.
And she's like, oh, you know, Marella had it. But I'm not sure. I think she's using it. And everyone starts to get loose. They're like smoking and like just kind of relaxing. But Maria goes into the hallway and she's crying. And the other woman comes out. She's like, oh, I know. I'm so sorry. Are you homesick? And Maria's sobbing. And she's like, no, I really wanted that work card because I wanted to be able to sell newspapers. And I can't now. I thought I was going to be able to get it. But if Marella has it, I can't. And the woman's like, well, you can apply for one. And Maria's like, I was deported a few months ago. I can't apply. And I didn't know if that meant you can't apply yet. I think maybe yet. But like, she's like, I can't apply for it. I'm just going to be here with nothing. And the woman's like, well, you'll find something. And Maria says, you know, one time back in Romania, I gave some money to, and she says, calls it gypsy beggar, but my hand touched hers. And I looked down, her hand was so dirty that I ran afterwards and I washed my hands and I was afraid I was going to get something from her. And she disgusted me. And then last winter, I was panhandling in Paris and this very well-dressed man goes to give me 20 francs. And then when he saw my outstretched hand, which was dirty, he threw the money in my lap in disgust. Aww. And I felt so ashamed of myself. Do you understand? And the woman's like, yeah. I everyone here, like,
we all get it.
Yeah. We see Anne kissing a man in a swimming pool. This is another production that she is in. Oh, no, sorry. This is the same movie. This is like why they move. I forget this. Sorry. So we see a scene of Anne in the movie. She's kissing her husband. They're in a swimming pool on their rooftop deck of their penthouse, 20 stories up. Laughing. And like they have genuine, like real chemistry. More so like we've never, like even when she and George are affectionate, like they've been together a long time and they have that energy.
Yes.
And her and this actor are like laughing. Like they genuinely feel like, yes, like they are newlyweds or something. Yeah. And she looks up and they see their son balancing on the balcony's edge. And she screams, Perot. So he's also has the same name of the son from Cachet.
Oh, yes.
And they both jump out of the pool and they run to him. And this is the kind of thing you should not, no one should have. Like if you're going to be on the top of a building, you have to have higher, a fence or something.
Something.
And this little boy especially can pull himself children. Up. Exactly. He starts to slip off. He would obviously explode when he hit the ground at that height.
Of course.
And they're barely able to save him, but they pull him back up. And she's like, why did you climb up there? He's like, look, there's a balloon. And it's a balloon caught in like a weather vane.
Yeah.
And she just hauls off and slaps him in the face. The dad says to him, if you do that again, you'll get your first spanking ever. And then the parents embrace, but because there's obviously chemistry between them, they start just like making out and kind of forgetting about him until he pipes up and his dad said, I want you to get out of here. Do we have to watch you every second? And she says, we have to move. We can't live on the 20th floor. I can't worry all the time. I'm calling the realtor. We then see her and the actor who plays the husband. They're in the voiceover booth. And this is clearly like she's falling in love with this guy.
Of course.
They're trying to do their lines and they keep laughing and they're having fun. And it turns out like there's a plane flying over the pool scene. Yeah. So they're trying to like redo the lines, but they're like so giggly and again, effortless in a way that she and George never are. And we then are in a cab. We're driving through a marketplace in Africa. We're inside the father's cab, and he is, again, half a world away. He's driving, back at work. We see Anne go home from the recording session on the train, and we see two young rapscallions, one who's called the young Arab, and of course he is the one who plays Majid's son in Cachet, wonderful performer. And he starts like wolf whistling at Anne, like, ooh, are you a model? You look like an actress. I feel like I recognize you. Oh, your chauffeur must be off for the day. And she starts to like try to go down to the other end of the car, and he's like following. He's like, oh, you don't want to talk to an Arab? I mean, just because I'm an Arab doesn't mean I don't want a little affection. But also he's like 19, you know what I mean? Right. Like he's just like talking shit, and his friend's like laughing, like, oh, I can't believe you're saying that to her. He's like, I just think you're one of those high society, beautiful, rich people. You know, how can you be so beautiful and so arrogant? And he follows it. And then he goes and he sits down next to her. He's like, oh, are you going to snubby in front of everyone? You're going to hop cars? And then when he sits next to her, he sort of like falls silent and looks out the window and just stops yelling at her until the door opens and he turns and he spits in her face.
Ugh.
And when he starts to run out the door, the guy next to her trips him. This is the actor who played Majid from Cachet.
Okay.
And then the younger guy turns like, what the fuck, and gets in the guy's face. And the guy, the older guy stands up and hands and his glass and his glasses. Like he's going to get like fight this guy.
Yeah. Hold these. The younger, hoops of the older man.
Yeah. And the younger guy backs down. He's like, I'm not going to punch an old man, in the face. And hands the guy back his glasses and sort of like fishes a Kleenex out and washes off her face. And they go to the next stop. And the younger man's like, I see you again. Don't worry about that. And he screams and he sort of startles everyone. And Anne starts to cry. And she tells the man, thank you. And she bursts into tears. And in the park, Allison, on a beautiful Parisian day, we see a huge drum performance. All the kids, Seminata's there, Amadou's there, like all the kids from the neighborhood who are part of this like drum circle are there. And all it's like, again, the multicultural dream. It's like a beautiful park on the river. We see the metro go by. All of these like kids and adults are watching them. And sort of the promise of France, the promise of America, or like this idea of multiculturalism that like is the idea of it and the look of it, but then doesn't really like have any bandwidth to discuss like why does it have to be this way or like what people's personal, you know, sorrow is. And we see Maria back in Paris. And it just makes me think of like the anti-homeless laws that are, you know, it being instituted incoming, and have been instituted in America. Like how you just, you know, can't be anywhere. You know, you can't loiter, you can't sit down, you can't sleep in the park, and how, you know, that will just lead to people being arrested and, you know, again, put in prison for the crime of being poor.
Yes.
And we see her, she's carrying her bags and she's walking around trying to find just like a same area, like a little alleyway to sit in. And this time when she sits on the steps, a shop owner immediately notices her and goes inside, and these two guys come over and tell her, like, you can't sit here. So she kind of has to scoop up her bags. And we see there's more shuttered businesses, which, again, I you know, like, you, like, that will just happen more and more. Like, she's walking up and down these streets. Like, there's places where they're, you know, you see these closed shop fronts. And she's just walking around alone. And we see Anne emerge from the subway. She's walking past the beautiful cafes. It reminded me how, like, in Fox News, they're always like, oh, New York is so dangerous. And it's like, you really just mean that you can see black people and poor people and people of color and immigrants.
Yep.
And you have – and you in order to make people not care, you have to make them afraid and pretend that people are dangerous and, like, how this is just the nature of the world and these cities are – beautiful and like, you know, I think it's like it starts to rain and she's like walking through Paris and she enters her door code and walks into her building. And George gets home in the rain. And before he goes inside, he goes into there's like a hair salon type of place and he buys her perfume. So sort of like a pharmacy type of thing and gets her a little treat. Yeah. And the entire time the drums are playing. So we're hearing the drums. There's no talking, but you hear the drums from the park. And he enters the door code, Allison. It's wrong. And I was like, oh, he doesn't know it. But then when I was looking up online, someone on Reddit was like, it's been changed.
It's been changed.
It's, like, it's been changed. He would know it.
Yeah.
And so obviously, like, she has completely dropped him, which again, I think is like, alludes to like, that's her privilege. Like the idea that she could just decide this and cast him aside.
Yeah.
And not be able to reflect on like, you know, she just had this like scary, unsettling, weird experience on the subway. But like, that's like a private internal experience versus able to be like, oh, like I should recognize the ways in which we're all terrified and like having these like weird interactions. I'm just going to change the code. And then he goes across the street to the phone booth. It's torrentially raining, calls up. She doesn't pick up. It goes to voicemail and he tries to hail a taxi, but no one will stop. And we end, we see another sweet little baby signing. And he signs a whole story. And it's like very, he's smiling and it's a really happy story, but there's no translation. And I think where Edwin's like, well, what is it?
Right.
The end. Code unknown.
Oh, code unknown.
Yeah.
Oh, code, like door code.
Yes. Well, I think it's sort of like,
but you know.
Yeah. But also it's like, oh, if the code is like, if we could understand that we're all in this, you know.
Yes.
But yes, I think literalizing is very funny at the end. It's like, he does not know the code is unknown because she changed it.
Ooh, what a good one.
Yeah.
I mean, not a horror film, but like
I know.
A good movie that I would like to watch.
It was really good. Yeah, I really loved it.
He knows how to make a movie. That Michael Haneke.
I know it's sort of like, well, it's not a cliche, but it's like, boy, it really makes sense why they're letting him keep making these. He's phenomenal at it.
It makes me like sad that I feel like there are not as many directors who get to have like,
yeah.
Like there's like Nolan, I feel yeah. like, you know, and then like obviously like the other old guard of just like Scorsese and Coppola, like the, but like even really like Coppola like couldn't make Megalopolis or whatever, like, be the hit that he wants. Like, it's just like, oh, I miss people just getting to be like, I have a style. I'm going to keep making different kinds of movies in that style and that they continue to get made rather than kind of like that director being forced to go do a Marvel series for Disney Plus or something. Yeah.
Well, like, I think it's like, well, first of all, we talk about private equity entering into like all these industries, including Hollywood, where, this movie is not making $500 million. This movie is attempted a thoughtful rumination on modern society that are going to be seen by people who already probably know who Michael Haneke is or in film school.
Right.
Oh, and then like, this is the kind of thing like you'd pick up at the movie store and you'd be like, oh, I actually really enjoyed this.
Yeah,
you know, like,
right.
So you would find over time.
It's the rental market that does and the DVD purchasing market that doesn't exist anymore. That was what kind of kept these kinds of films financially afloat.
Yes. Oh yeah. Like the amount of money, like even if it wasn't a hit in the theaters, you could make a lot of money with DVDs. Yeah. It's just, I did think that too. It's like, wow, he really just has hit after hit, you know, not that like, I think these movies I think are very different, so it doesn't make sense to compare them. But I really appreciate it. It's like, yeah, this was not a movie having seen his other films, I thought this was going to be a much more of a
darker,
psychologically fucked up. You know, I thought there was going to be way more fucked up moments. It's like, oh, this is actually very tender and like sad and like thoughtful. So I'm so glad that he was able to make this.
Yeah,
but yeah, I hope and wish that there are other directors. There's definitely plenty of directors that I wish you know would be able to just make like I want to see 5 to 7 other movies, right? Like I would love to see that. And, you know, some of them are, and I really hope more and more people get to be able to, and this is like, yes, this is he's more expensive of a movie, but like the other movies, other than the settings, because everyone's wealthy in them.
Right.
You know, they're not super expensive to shoot, I imagine.
No, you can make them.
And then, what are some fatal mistakes made in Code Unknown?
Fatal mistakes.
I mean, not necessarily that it ended in death in most of the scenarios, but just like the like deep inability for so many people to communicate what they really feel, like with the farmer and Jean and Anne and George in general. I mean, I guess they could communicate, but they just couldn't like actually deal with the problems they were communicating to each other, and her just like changing the code at the end. It's like, all right, well, but even with kind of like Amadou's family and his dad and siblings, and just feels like when you're living under this, like, a you know, when the world feels relatively oppressive, even for the privileged people, it's like, oh, and then we just won't tap into our emotions and everything's a little more surface.
Okay, so the box office was, the budget was $7.3 million.
For this?
Yep. And the box office was
$310,000. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, but again, glad he was able to make other movies, you know?
Right, and If you make a whole bunch of movies and some are hits and some are not, that's fine as long as it all even, like, it's just like, that's okay that not everything is just like a run. I mean, I guess that's like a pretty big debt.
Well, but also like I would wonder, and obviously this is on me to do more research, but it's like a lot of other countries like have like, you know, like grants and programs like that are funded by the government.
Right.
And I think Vera Drew, the director of The People's Joker, was talking about, she showed her movie at Outfest here in LA.
Oh, yeah. Whatever, I remember you've said this.
Yeah, a couple years ago. And she was talking about like somebody from South Korea had a film. And there was like a Q&A afterwards, and they said like, well, so where did you get the funding? And the woman had to be like, oh, I'm so sorry. Other countries have arts funding. I got the funding from the government to make this queer film. I'm so, you know, like, yeah, I'm so sorry. It's like, oh, right, only in America, not only America, but it's like, yeah, we make it. So it's like, okay, we have to make a Garfield movie that makes $500 million. And then you can make your thoughtful art house film about immigration. You know?
Even that will still like, likely not happen. You will have to finance that, and it's garbage.
Man, but man. A great film. And again, it's like if you're a scaredy cat watching this, I think you would really enjoy this.
Yeah, I want to watch this one. Maybe I will over the holidays.
All right. And then where would you place this on the spooky scale, Allison?
A spooky scale.
I think, you know, this is a one. I think there are moments that are on. I think the audition where it is a slight moment of like, oh, is this the audition or is this a trap that this woman has found herself in as an actress auditioning? Like, is kind of a, ugh. But it's obviously not a scary film. So a one.
I'm going to go with that too. I agree. I also feel that way about the cattle dying. I think was like, oh no. Okay.
Yeah.
But like terrifying in a way where it's like you could see somebody doing that. Mm-hmm. I really, really enjoy this film. High recommend. Not scary at all.
Not scary.
All right, great. Great. Thank you so much for listening, everybody.
Yes.
We hope you're having a wonderful December.
Holiday season.
And we'll see you there when we finally catch up with your timeline.
Yeah.
And until then, please.
Please keep it spooky.
Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Ruin Podcast,
or join us at patreon.com/ruinpodcast for exclusive episodes and video content.
Ruin is a Radio Point production with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Dan Powell, and Houston Snyder.
Recorded and edited by Kat Iosa and Olivia Posner.
Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.